Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when you're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you hit play on your iPod, iPad, or computer, or whatever device you're storing the show on. Today we're doing a long overdue show on the Seventh Circuit Electronic Discovery Pilot Program. I've had this on my list to do for about a year and a half, and at times I've had up to six potential panelists on the show, all of whom would have been great, but anyone who's ever tried to do things with large numbers of volunteers can understand how hard it is to make that particular show happen. So I picked two speakers, one of whom I worked on a program I helped with in May on technology-assisted review presented by the Seventh Circuit Technology Subcommittee, which I worked with Jeff Scharrer on, who's on the show. And then I picked two of the original speakers, Art Goldwitzer from F&B LLP and Michael Bolton from Baxter Healthcare. So now we managed to push this ahead pretty quickly in a couple of weeks. The Seventh Circuit Electronic Discovery Pilot Program is really an incredibly important development in e-discovery, as the court and its participants have created what amounts to a science laboratory environment as they attempt to move the field of electronic discovery forward by studying where the problems usually occur and working collectively to solve them. We're going to learn more about these efforts over the course of the show, but there are also some general principles and guidelines which litigants follow, and a commitment to sharing continuing education for free to flexibly improve electronic discovery. It's truly a remarkable exercise, and I'm proud to say that I'm a member of the technology subcommittee led by Sean Byrne and Thomas Thompson in the Seventh Circuit, and have been contributing written content when asked, and gave some, I think, incredible acting skills to a videotaped skit on predictive coding, although the tape won't lie. So I encourage people to go to www.discoverypilot.com, which is the website that houses the information from the Seventh Circuit Electronic Discovery Pilot Program. It's got a wealth of information, and I think this video skit will be up there at some point soon. Now for our guests. Mike Bolton oversees litigation for Baxter Healthcare Corporation in Deerfield, Illinois. His cases range from product liability matters to complex commercial disputes to intellectual property conflicts. Not surprisingly, given the diversity of the litigation subject matter, the forms for the litigation are diverse as well, with matters being heard in state and federal court in the U.S., to courts and tribunals in Asia, Europe, and South America. An understanding of litigation risks has also moved Mike to play a role in information management at Baxter, supporting efforts to align corporate interests in legal and IT tools and solutions. Jeff Scharrer, our second panelist, concentrates in securities and professional liability litigation and SEC and PCAOB enforcement work on behalf of public accounting firms and their members. Jeff also concentrates in matters related to electronic discovery and information management. He's a member of Sidley's Electronic Discovery Task Force, a longtime member of the Sedona Conference, and also a member of the Seventh Circuit Electronic Discovery Pilot Program. Jeff frequently counsels clients in the areas of preservation, collection, review, and production of electronically stored information in all manner of litigation, regulatory and investigative proceedings, as well as in advisory matters outside of litigation context, and he's a frequent speaker on these topics. Our last guest, Art Goldwitzer, is a partner at F&B LLP in Austin, Texas, which is a high-powered boutique of former large law firm litigators who specialize in patent litigation. Art combines trial and appellate experience gained as a federal prosecutor in the Southern District of New York with 17 years of experience, including jury trials and appeals, handling patent, copyright, trademark, and trade secret litigation. He also has experience in a wide range of litigation outside of intellectual property and criminal law, including employment, partnership, breach of fiduciary duty, breach of contract, construction, and antitrust litigation. Prior to joining F&B, he was a partner at both the law firms of Kirkland Ellis and Michael Best and Friedrich in Chicago, Illinois. Art's professional activities in electronic discovery include serving in the Seventh Circuit's pilot program on electronic discovery and serving as chairman of the Seventh Circuit Bar Association's Intellectual Property Committee, as well as a number of other IP-related organizations around the country. So, great panel. Looking forward to starting the show here. So, before, when we start, our first question typically is, how did you get interested in electronic discovery. So why don't we start in the order I introduced you, Mike, then Jeff, then Art.
Yeah, thanks, Carl. As an in-house counsel, you have to be interested in e-discovery because now all discovery is e-discovery. If we have boxes of paper to produce, it gets imaged and gets put into the queue with the electronic documents. So all matters that we have become e-discovery matters. So you've got to be up on it. You got to be up on it because of the huge cost first. That's where people first see it in terms of how tremendously expensive it is to go through the process when you're dealing with a large, complex case with hundreds of thousands of documents. But then secondly, the risk. If your e-discovery process is not handled well, if protections aren't in place, if you're not playing an active role with your outside providers, with your counsel, the risks can come up and hit you in litigation and in battles before the court.
Okay, Jeff?
Sure. As far as my original interest, I've always had a, I guess what you call a hobbyist interest in computers and technology. So when issues like electronic file formats and systems and data maps and metadata all started to matter in litigation, it was a natural evolution in my practice. And what I found in recent years, as Michael noted, is that this has now become one of the areas of greatest cost and greatest risk and from my perspective, greatest opportunity to assist clients in navigating this process. It's not something that you can it's not something that can be avoided anymore, and it's as I view it, a tremendous and very interesting and engaging opportunity.
And how about yourself, Art?
I have a somewhat similar story to tell, I guess. I came out of law school in the early 90s, and I think classmates of mine, and including me, were using email and using electronic documents probably before our firms at the time officially were doing so. And then, you know, we were the early adopters of using tools like concordance and summation to organize document productions. And as time went on and I became more senior, I just decided not to relegate this to more junior attorneys, but to take a hands-on approach. And I still do today for the reasons that Mike pointed out. This is an area where there's risk, but there's danger. And as outside counsel, it's our responsibility to help our clients to avoid the dangers. So I take a personal interest in the area, and then ultimately, I think it was the spring of 2009 that the Seventh Circuit Bar Association's annual conference ran into Judge Holderman. He was just starting to put the group together, and he asked if I wanted to join, and I jumped at the opportunity. You know, here we are 3 years later, just finishing up phase two of the project.
That's great. So we'll get into that in a little bit. So, Jeff, how did the Seventh Circuit e-discovery pilot program start? I mean, what were its goals and its structure in the beginning?
Well, the pilot program really was I'd call it the brainchild of Judges Holderman and Nolan. And as Art mentioned, in early 2009, Judges Nolan and Holderman started the project and started by assembling a group of both lawyers and non-lawyers who were expert in the field of ESI to identify what the group thought were the most pressing needs in the area of e-discovery and in particular to further the goals of Rule 1 of the federal rules, the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of cases. The goals at the outset really were threefold. One was to develop a set of principles that could help minimize cost and burden of discovery in proportion to, you know, litigation, but principles that are fair to all and that both achieve the end of managing the discovery process and achieving efficiency, but at the same time providing enough information to be sufficient to the presentation of the party's claims and defenses and without compromising in any way fairness or zealous advocacy. To that end, some of the key principles that I think we'll touch on later will be, you know, cooperation and proportionality principles that built on guidance that was then coming out of and is still continuing to come out of the Sedona Conference. Also principles that had the flexibility to adjust to the needs of what is a very wide range of cases with which the judicial system deals. So large cases, small cases, complex and simple. The program then sought to implement the principles in court cases and then actually measure in a meaningful scientific way the results, and that's done through a survey process at the end of each phase. The committee is chaired by Judges Holderman and Nolan, and it has several subcommittees, all of which have their own subcommittee chairs and co-chairs. The committee meets periodically at the district. Subcommittees meet as needed in between those, and membership on the committee has been open and inclusive with a very heavy emphasis on drawing from all corners of the bar in order to make sure that all points of view are represented in the development and refinement of these principles.
Mike, as a related question, let's talk a little bit about the point that we were just mentioning there, Jeff was mentioning about the diversity of the group, which is really fairly impressive. Does that make it challenging for the group or make it more effective?
Yeah, I think it makes it more challenging, but that's a good thing about this kind of group, because we meet and there's spirited discussion, and I think most of the discussion is in the committees. But let me just give a little bit of background on the diversity of the group. I mean, there are over 80 participants here, and that number is regularly growing. And by diversity, I don't just mean that there are plaintiffs' representatives and defendants' representatives, but there is diversity within each group. So you've got litigators from outside firms who handle large, complex matters, but also sole practitioners from small firms who work on more regular disputes, attorneys who devote high level of resources to a case, and attorneys who have clients who are cash-strapped and resource-poor, public defender's office. Then there's also government participants, from prosecutors and state's attorneys to public defenders. Then you go to the client side. I mean, Baxter is only one of three healthcare providers who are participants, so it's a tremendously representative, diverse group. And the discussion is challenging and exciting. There's some stuff which we couldn't get agreement on, but there was a tremendous amount of material where we were able to have agreement, because the participants here are mostly sophisticated. They have dealt deeply with issues in the e-discovery area. And once you get that group of smart, experienced people in a room, you can get consensus. And I think that diversity is going to give us a more limited set of directions, which you'll see in the principles. A lot of them seem kind of obvious. But also, these principles, I think, will have a great legitimacy. And they'll be accepted throughout the bar. And they have been, based on the survey results from phase one and phase two, because the panel is representative across such a broad area. And I think the next step is to make it even more representative by taking in people from broader geographies from outside the Seventh Circuit.
Great.
Well, this is Art. Can I add a piece to that? Judge Holderman and Judge Nolan have always emphasized that while they're the guiding force behind this, they wanted the bar to write these principles. They didn't want it to be something a group of judges handed down. And I think that's, I don't know if that makes us unique, but I think it makes us different than a lot of the other ESI projects out there. That diverse group that Mike and Jeff just described, we as a group, we wrote these things. So you talk about legitimacy. This is something that practicing lawyers from all walks of life came up with. And the result of that is that the principles can be applied in so many different situations, large cases, small cases, cases with a lot of money at stake, cases with not a lot of money at stake. They're flexible, and they contemplate a lot of different contingencies, I think, because of that big, diverse group that wrote them.
Do you think that there's some element of sort of Midwest core values of reasonableness that have helped shape what you've been able to come up with? I mean, I can play it both ways. My family's from the Chicago area, both sides of the family, and then one, my dad moved to New York, so I grew up in New York, but then I returned to Pittsburgh. So I've seen the differences, and I, you know, depending on the group, I'll play like a more of a Midwesterner, but if I were in New York, I'd probably say something a little bit different, I guess. But do you think that has helped as well, that even though you're a large city, you know, the Midwest is known for being practical?
Well, this is Jeff. I think that the, you know, yes and no. I think that you know, a lot of what you see in the principles that our committee has developed really tracks a lot of what, as I mentioned earlier, you see coming out of the Sedona Conference. And, you know, the Sedona Conference is, you know, is even more geographically diverse than you know, than our committee, with you know, members from coast to coast. So I you know, I do think that, you know, anytime you have a group that at least starts you know, drawn heavily from a particular area, you know, it certainly that at some level will affect the process and the output. But I think that our principles are, you know, entirely consistent with what you see from groups like Sedona with even a broader participation.
Well, let's talk about some of the specific principles. The duty to meet and confer, Art, what does the Seventh Circuit counsel on this principle?
Well, as it sounds, there is a duty to meet and confer. The principles require the parties to meet and confer early in the case, before the initial status conference. And, you know, and the federal courts around the country handle that initial status or that Rule 26F conference in different ways, but the gist of it is, do this up front. Know your ESI, know your client. Talk to, if you know, if Mike is your client, talk to him, find out what their systems are about, find out where you're going to have trouble, find out, you know, maybe how you want to preserve and or produce information, what's most cost effective, and come to that conference, you know, prepare to speak knowledgeably. If you don't, the principles contemplate that the courts can, I guess, punish you in a sense. It doesn't come out and say that, but there's a carrot and stick approach buried in there. The court can preclude a party from starting ordinary discovery if they aren't participating in the process in good faith from the beginning. The principles are new enough where I'm not sure how much that has happened, but I, as someone who helped write those principles, I believe judges should do it. Because one of the challenges we all face are cases where it's someone's strategy to be non-cooperative, and the emphasis on cooperation throughout these principles requires that someone, that either parties willingly be cooperative or that the court twist their arm a little bit. Once they meet and confer, and there's another concept that travels throughout, there runs throughout these principles, and that is, I think of it as a tennis ball bouncing back and forth between the two courts. The two sides are able to carve out their own safe harbors, in a sense. We can sit down, if Jeff and I are on opposite sides of a case, I can say, look, you know, we don't want to preserve a certain kind of metadata, or I need to give my client assurance that they don't need to go out and mirror image every single hard drive. And he can say, nope, it's a trade secrets case. I really need those. And I say, well, how about for a few specific custodians? And if we can agree, great. And if we can't, we should bring our dispute to the court right away so that we get it resolved. And the idea being that we know what the ground rules are from the beginning. You can't lay in wait and claim spoliation 6 months down the road if it's something you could have raised at this first meet and confer. So the idea was get problems out on the table, get them resolved, and get the parties moving forward with an efficient plan for discovery.
Go ahead.
You know, this is Mike. Let me just emphasize one point that Jeff made, that I think the principles are really useful in countering those litigants who strategically are kind of gaming e-discovery issues to try to gain some advantage or use some undue demand on their opposition. The principles kind of require people to address those issues upfront, has some defaults about what parties are obligated to do that kind of simplify the process and remove some of those opportunities for people to game the system. So these principles are designed to avoid kind of the lawyer who's going to use e-discovery just as a strategy.
Yeah, Mike, I couldn't agree more. This is Art. When working on these, I was so personally concerned that discovery was turning into a game of gotcha. And thinking of this as outside counsel, you know, you get that call from a client, what do I have to do? What do I have to preserve? I want to be able to give the client firm answers and not the typical lawyerly, well, you can probably do this, but we can never be real sure. If we can get these issues resolved up front and we can all proceed with some certainty, that was one of my goals.
One of the aspects that's unique to the Seventh Circuit program is this e-discovery liaison. Mike, would you like to tell us about this requirement?
Yeah, this is often a role that's played by someone in-house at the client, and it's one of the most useful aspects of the principles. The party designates at the time of the initial meet and confer an individual who has knowledge of the party's internal systems, their internal e-discovery efforts, and can participate in e-discovery dispute resolution. So I think of this person as being kind of the translator. They can translate the IT issues about what's accessible, what the risks are, what the difficulties are of accessing stuff, what's available and what's not, to the lawyers, so that the lawyers then understand what's really achievable, what's reasonable, and make their decisions on proportionality. And this is proven to be, in the surveying that's been done of people who are following the principles, the most valuable portion of the principles. 90% of the attorneys who have cases that are operating under the principles say that this was an incredible boon for efficiency of the case in resolving e-discovery disputes. Even more useful, or more surprising, I guess, is that 75% of the lawyers said their opponent's e-discovery liaison. So they're identifying their opponent's expert on IT as having been someone who also contributed to the efficiency of the process. So this has really proven to be a very useful tool, and I think it's one aspect of the principles that should be adopted in cases outside of the Seventh Circuit. For us, we'll use someone from our IT group who works regularly with the lawyers who can participate in meeting confers, explain what we have accessible, what the difficulties are, and they're a good teacher. So they're good at teaching our opponents and also our outside counsel what's available and what's accessible.
Right. And this is Jeff. I'd just add, one of the things that this was designed to avoid is the old model of the meet and confer, where your e-discovery issues would come up, and what you'd have are lawyers not prepared to address them. You'd have a meet and confer that ends with a lot of, we'll look into it and get back to you. And then you've got the, all of the risk, you've got the risk that's posed anywhere by electronic information, which is that the more time that passes, things that might have been small issues today become bigger and bigger issues with each passing day. And so this is intended really to, like the meet and confer provisions, to facilitate that early discussion, early identification of disputes so that they can be resolved. And one of the innovative things about this principle is that your ESI liaison, as Michael mentioned, does not have to be a lawyer. It can be your in-house IT person. It can be litigation support professionals, either from your law firm or from the client. It can be attorneys, and I've had matters also where we've designated more than one person to serve in the role of ESI liaison. So for certain topics, we'll have one person, and other topics, we'll have another. The key is really having the knowledge and understanding involved in the process, and it's recommended at all stages of the meet and confer. It's actually required under the principle in the event that there is a dispute. But it's, as Mike mentioned, it's one of the things most often pointed to as really advancing the goals that we talked about at the outset of the pilot program.
Yeah, it seems like it's one way that you could proactively address, for at least cases that move forward beyond just the potential litigation, to deal with the crushing burden of over-preservation.
Carl,
I can see that right away. Go ahead.
Hey, Kyle, this is Art. And so as not to scare any listeners who maybe work on smaller cases, this, again, is an area that's flexible. As Jeff just mentioned, it can be a non-attorney who is an IT specialist from a big company. But if you're the plaintiff representing a single person in a, you know, let's say a Title VII case or something, you can do this yourself. It just means you need to talk to your client. And, you know, does your client have a laptop? Do they have an email account? Are the emails stored in the cloud, or are they stored on the hard drive? It requires that someone be knowledgeable, but I don't think we should give anyone the impression that you have to go out and have a specially trained expert either. I think there's some folks who look at these principles and are concerned that they're only well suited for big company disputes, but they're not that rigid. They require that you have knowledge on this topic, but it can be anybody.
Good points. The next principles, Jeff, focus on preservation requests and orders. And if you want to tell us a little bit more about this area, Jeff.
Sure. One of the issues that the committee identified during the early discussions, during the early committee meetings, is the this problem. Most of us have received or sent these shotgun style preservation requests, where you get a letter that says we're suing you, and we're requiring, or you're required to produce or to preserve anything and everything, essentially preserve everything under the sun, and those often then are get a response along the lines of we understand what our obligations are, and we will do what we need to do, and we object to your letter to the extent it calls for anything beyond what we're obligated to do. The committee recognized that that exchange is generally entirely unhelpful. It's often undertaken by the requesting party in order to set up the sort of gotcha scenario that Art and Michael touched on earlier. The purpose of the principle then, or the objective of the principle, is to acknowledge that in some cases a early communication regarding preservation actually can be not only appropriate but valuable, but to provide some specific guidance to help that exchange be as useful as it can be. And so what the principle does is it says, to the extent that a preservation request is going to be made or a preservation order is going to be sought, it needs to be a meaningful request, in that it needs to contain detail regarding things such as the parties involved, some factual background, names of potential witnesses, relevant time period, things that can focus the discussion and give the receiving party something to which they can then respond at a comparable level of specificity. And by doing that, do away with this sort of blunderbuss approach to setting up the gotcha game, and really get to an exchange that, like the other principles we've discussed, fosters an early discussion, an early meaningful discussion of issues that are going to be presented in a case, and potentially to crystallize some of your disagreements early on, so that you can either work them out by agreement, or if you need to, seek a resolution from the court.
Okay, and I don't know if you have anything else to add to that, Art, from your perspective as an outside litigator on the scope of preservation.
Yeah, I can add a little. This the preservation letter issue leads to that analogy or metaphor I used earlier of the tennis ball bouncing from one side of the court to the other. We were concerned as a group about these blunderbuss preservation letters. We didn't want to legitimize them in any way, but we also didn't want to say you couldn't do it. This is sometimes these letters are sent before a lawsuit is even filed, and if a recipient of the letter doesn't like it, well, there isn't even a judge to go to yet. So what do you do? So again, this ties into the early meet and confer and having a liaison or getting yourself up to speed on your client's electronic files. But once the case starts, then it's time to talk. And if somebody, could be either side, plaintiff or defendant, sends a preservation letter that is reasonable and targeted and says, you know what, I need the hard drives of the following five people, you know, you can say yes or you can say no. And if you say no, you know, let's go to the court and get it resolved. Likewise, you can bring up or put in writing the opposite of a preservation letter, a letter that says, I'm affirmatively not going to do certain things. You know, we rotate our backup tapes every year. They're very expensive. We're not going to save them. We're not going to restore them. We won't destroy anything else, but we're not going to deal with the backup tapes or whatever the example may be. Maybe it's metadata. Maybe it's all the data that gets sent by smartphone today, text messages, instant messages, that sort of thing. You move back and forth, creating safe harbors. And by safe harbor, I mean if one side says, I want something, and you don't object, and later on it turns out that you destroyed it, even though you were on notice, well, then they probably do have a good spoliation claim. On the other hand, if you objected and said, I'm not going to preserve that, I can't do it, it's too expensive, you don't need it, then, and the other side does nothing about it, well, then they probably shouldn't be heard to yell spoliation 6 months or a year down the line. The principles actually go a little further to add some guidance. There's some categories that are presumptively, not discoverable is the wrong word, but presumptively not in play for preservation and review and production. And it is things like hard to reach metadata. At one point, one of our committee members coined the phrase volatile ESI, and we didn't use that in the principle itself because we were afraid of doing anything that would be would be outpaced or outdated by the technology before these principles were even in place. But I always liked the concept. It stuck in my mind that if it's data that disappears every time you turn on your computer, if it's data that disappears simply by your employees or custodians doing their jobs, then it's presumptively not in play. Again, we come back to the point, though, that if one side says, no, this is a special case, this is a trade secrets case, I really need to get the hard drive of witness X and get it in as pristine of condition as possible, well, then you're on notice that maybe those presumptive safe harbors don't apply, and you either work it out or you go to the judge as fast as you can and get it worked out. And this all, as I keep saying, is customizable to your case. If it's a big case, maybe you need lots of custodians. If it's a small case, maybe you can make the process more efficient than federal litigation stereotypically is by really honing in on a couple key people, a couple key computer hard drives. I've even had cases where we agree we're not going to look at email ever unless good cause is shown because it just doesn't seem to matter. So you can make this as the parties can make this as broad or as narrow as they can agree upon, and to the extent they can't agree, they should bring this up at the initial status conference and get it resolved in that first scheduling order.
Mike, there's some nuts and bolts issues when it comes to identifying potential ESI. How does the Seventh Circuit counsel parties on the identification of ESI?
Well, the principles require the parties to address identification of ESI early. So they're required to do it at the meet and confer process. And this was a revision from the phase one version of the principles where the parties were just it was suggested that they talk about identifying ESI and the different methods for calling it and producing it. But after phase one, the feedback was that it was having no impact, that people would do it when they wanted to, and that was pretty spineless. So the language now is much clearer in terms of saying the parties are to discuss the identification of relevant and discoverable ESI, and then to discuss different methods for calling that producing relevant material, such as things like keyword searching, the elimination of duplicative ESI, filtering of data by certain search parameters. So that type of methodology is now within the principles. And generally, by identifying these issues in the meet and confer and in other aspects of the principles, they push conflict over ESI up front. So the parties battle this out either back and forth in the tennis match, which has been described, or before the court, up front, before there's expense, before a party can really justify, you know, a spoliation motion later on. And in that way, initially, the principles don't seem like they really resolve conflict because the courts and the participants see the conflict up front. But in the long term, the issues are resolved when there's less risk and less resources devoted to them. And I think in the long term, it'll make the cases run more efficiently. So I'm going to be really interested in looking at the results of the phase two feedback to see if people are really seeing a long-term reduction in disputes over ESI.
You know, actually, you said a couple things in there that, you know, professionally always pique my interest whenever you hear the words keyword searching. It sort of leads into the next question here, Jeff, because you were involved with the program I helped with last May on computer-assisted review or predictive coding that the Seventh Circuit put on, and the goal was to train participants on the potential advantages offered by using the predictive coding for litigants and participants. And you know, but then when you were identifying approaches and you know, sometimes when you spell out the types of things that need to be done, we tend to look backwards. And I've done programs with other court systems that have spelled out what needs to be done with keywords, and sometimes I think that might be a little bit too rigid when we look at technology looking forward. But you know, that program that we did in May seemed rather strongly slanted in the direction of using these types of tools and trying to offer education. So how do you see the Seventh Circuit evolving in this direction versus, you know, holding on to the past? I'm sorry for the confusing question. It's the day after a major holiday.
No, and I understand the question. You know,
I'm not repeating it.
As a general matter, before I speak to the technology-assisted review, you know, I think as we touched on earlier, one of the key pillars in the pilot program has been education, and this is, you know, early on in the discussion, members of the committee agreed that one of the big obstacles to efficient and cost-effective e-discovery was simply lack of knowledge by members of the bar on basic ESI concepts. And so during phases one and two, the education subcommittee had rolled out a number of programs, you know, several live webinars and several webinar-based programs and several live programs, and with attendance in the, you know, 10 to 12,000 range. So achieving a fairly broad reach. The program, Carl, that you're referring to in May was one of the more creative. It was program put together by the education subcommittee and the technology subcommittee, one of the more creative and I'll say having attended and presented at, you know, many of these programs over the past several years, I thought one of the most engaging and informative that I'd been at. The feedback's been outstanding, and you know, as you mentioned, it was specific to, you know, what it did address specifically technology-assisted review. Certainly a large component of the program was explaining the potential advantages to predictive coding and technology-assisted review. And in terms of additional guidance and where the pilot program is likely to go on that, I think, actually, I know that you will see some additional guidance come out in the form of education, and one of the things that I know, Carl, you're, you know, involved in firsthand is developing a written primer that the technology subcommittee intends to issue on predictive coding to, you know, complement the May program. I think when that's done, hopefully over the next month or two, it'll be distributed to everyone who registered for that program, as well as posted on the pilot program's website at which is www.discoverypilot.com. All of the other educational programs that I referred to also are available on discoverypilot.com. because education's been a sort of a cornerstone for the committee, I would expect that as long as predictive coding and technology-assisted review continue to evolve and they continue to gain traction in the e-discovery process, they will be appropriately represented in the committee's educational initiatives, and particularly under the technology subcommittee, which really only got off the ground during the second half of phase two. I don't expect to see any significant, you know, technology-specific revisions to the principles as we head into phase three. You know, the committee has been careful to remain, you know, platform and technology and vendor agnostic, and also the, you know, these tools, at least in their application to the legal problems, they're still relatively new. But they are, you know, that said, they are implicated by several of the principles in their current form, including, you know, we've got 2.01, which includes, you know, among issues to be discussed during the meet and confer process, you know, methodologies for, you know, culling relevant and discoverable ESIN documents from, you know, an initial subset of information. You've got Principle 2.05 on identification that Michael touched on, which also includes, as a topic for discussion at 26F, any plans to use keyword searching and various other tools, including advanced calling technologies. So I guess bottom line is that based on what we've seen so far of the development of predictive coding and the emerging case law in this area, with one of the more significant cases actually having played out in Judge Nolan's courtroom in recent months, my expectation is that over time, you know, we'll see the the use of these tools, at least in cases involving larger complex volumes of ESI, will become an increasingly significant issue under the principles, and it'll be addressed by the committee, certainly through education, potentially through other guidance and or down the line refinements as appropriate. I just don't think we're at a point right now where you're going to see any changes to the principles heading into phase three that are specific to predictive coding and tech-assisted review.
And I just want to add, I think that's a smart way to do it. You know, that might surprise some of my listeners, but the analogy I've been giving in this space is this is a lot like if I were to give you the rules of how to play poker, would you go to Vegas and start betting everything? And I just think that much of the bar needs to learn not just what the different tools do, but how that it plays out in a litigation, because you got to react with these tools to things that occur. And if you're just dealing with a baseline of knowledge, you could fly a plane into a cliff. No one wants that to happen. But so I think that's a pretty practical approach, honestly.
And the principles as drafted, and this was a deliberate effort in drafting them, are written flexibly enough to accommodate the emergence of new technologies, you know, be it predictive coding or whatever might follow on predictive coding, without needing to go back and rewrite the principles to accommodate the technology.
Yep. So let's go to production. Art, how does the Seventh Circuit program treat production format issues?
It consistent with everything else we've been talking about. In that early conference, those early meetings between the parties, one of the things the principals direct the parties to talk about is what the ultimate production will look like. So, you know, Jeff was just describing, you're discussing how you get there, right? Are we going to use predictive coding? Are we going to use search terms? Are we going to do this the old-fashioned way and have human beings look at every scrap of paper or electronic paper? And then you get to, well, what do you do with it once you've found the responsive non-privileged stuff? Are we going to produce paper? Are we going to produce CDs? Are we going to produce PDFs or TIFF files? Are there going to be certain kinds of load files? This should be one of the least controversial areas because, at least in my experience, even when a party is being strategically non-cooperative on certain areas, when it comes to the nuts and bolts of what kind of files are you going to give me, it seems like this one should be something they can work out. The principle encourages cost sharing if one side or the other wants something out of the ordinary, you know, maybe they both agree that we're going to OCR everything. The portion of this that might be a little more controversial is in relation to the production of information contained in databases. And in my world, that often means the damages side of discovery in a patent case, where one side or the other wants sales, cost, profit type information. As we, most of us know, you know, businesses don't keep that stuff in multi-column green ledgers like they would have once upon a time. It's in an accounting system. It's in a database that can be queried in a number of ways. So this principle, the way I read it, would encourage parties to sit down and talk about what do you want in that report? What information do you want queried from the database? And is that reasonable? And is it proprietary? Is it covered by a protective order? All those sorts of things.
So let's go into some of the reactions of the program. Now we've gone through the principles. Mike, what was the early reaction of the program from your perspective in-house? Because in my experience, outside lawyers tend to be extremely interested in electronic discovery because they actually litigate. But in-house, the reactions can run the gamut from being very strong to sometimes pretty tepid. So do you have some sort of a feel for this?
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting observation, because I've always thought that in-house generally tends to be more interested in e-discovery because we pay the bill for it. And the issues that surround e-discovery require us to produce, you know, our IT people for depositions, our witnesses in potential hearings. So I think in-house, these were welcomed. But they were also recognized as kind of principles that good lawyers generally would follow in their cases generally in terms of, you know, reviewing these issues early, knowing where your e-discovery, where your ESI is stored, taking steps to preserve it, dealing with those issues up front with your opponent and the court. But this was welcomed both for that, but also for recognizing the way these things are handled. And then the defaults that are kind of set into the principles, such as, you know, the type of initial format produced, that backup copies are generally not in play unless there's a specific case made for it, that generally the parties, you know, aren't obligated to engage in discovery on discovery, again, unless a party makes a demonstration that that's really relevant for the court to go into. So I think these were generally really well received in-house. And I think if there's any controversy about aspects of it, in a few years, we'll all be looking at these principles and saying, well, of course, that's how you litigate these cases.
So, Art, tell us about the first phase results. You know, when did they come out? What was in them?
Well, the first phase ran from October 2009 through March of 2010. I guess I should back up before that. Most of the drafting was done in the summer of 2009 after Judge Holderman and Judge Nolan assembled their initial group of volunteers. So we worked that summer on the writing. The what we came up with was handed out to 13 judges in the Northern District of Illinois who implemented the principles in some of the cases on their dockets, and a survey of the participants was conducted. The results were compiled and are published on that discoverypilot.com website. And from there, we looked to see if there were any lessons we could learn. I think the other guys have mentioned some tweaks that were made, and then we moved on to phase two.
Okay, so let's talk about phase two, which was more recently completed. Jeff, would you like to share some of the lessons learned from phase two?
Sure, and again, the entirety of the phase two report is available on the discoverypilot.com website. You know, the main difference between phase two and phase one is that phase two played out on a much larger field than phase one. We went from 13 judges in 93 cases over 6 months to 40 judges in 296 cases studied over 2 years. We measured the feedback on the program through a survey process substantially the same as what we used at the end of phase one. And I'd say that the headlines for the survey results are that, you know, they were in many ways very similar to the results from phase one. In those cases where attorneys or judges with cases in the pilot program had a, you know, perceived the principles to have an effect, The effects were overwhelmingly positive with respect to facilitating cooperation by attorneys in handling e-discovery, enhancing the ability of attorneys to resolve disputes amicably, their ability to obtain relevant documents, and their ability to zealously represent clients, as well as advancing or ensuring, facilitating a process perceived by all involved to be fundamentally fair. The numbers are, and I won't read through too many of them, but the numbers that came back in the survey, for example, a handful out of the attorneys are that 36% thought that the principles improved cooperation. Only 2% thought that it decreased. 25% thought that it increased the ability to zealously represent clients. Only 3% thought it decreased. Similar statistics or responses for ability to resolve disputes and increasing fairness and ability to obtain relevant documents. And the numbers from the judges overwhelmingly agreed. Three-quarters of judges thought that the principles either improved or greatly improved cooperation with respect to e-discovery. None reported a decrease. Same thing, about three-quarters reporting that fairness either increased or greatly increased, and none reporting a decrease. So the again, the full survey results are available on the website, but the bottom line here is that the principles do seem to be having the positive effect on advancing those Rule 1 principles that we talked about at the outset. And what we'll do now is take a look at these phase 2 results, which the report was just issued within the past month or two, and address sometime between I think now and August, September, whether any further tweaks are necessary, and then we move into phase 3 of the program.
So, I thought it was interesting, Art, that twice as many judges thought the principles resulted in improved cooperation than the lawyers did. And similarly, their belief in the fairness of the resolution under the principles, twice as many judges thought that the principles contributed to a fairer result on e-discovery disputes.
Hmm. So, Art, the Seventh Circuit program, we've talked about some of the work you've been doing before the show, that it's really growing into a national effort, into the national e-discovery marketplace. I mean, I know of some lawyers in other cities who are joining an outreach program. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. I wound up moving, relocating from Chicago to Austin, Texas for family reasons, and wanted to stay involved in this program. So I said to Judge Holderman and Judge Nolan, why don't we have a national outreach effort, and I'll coordinate it. So what we've been doing in a nutshell is gathering volunteers from around the country who are familiar with the Seventh Circuit principles, generally people who think they're a good idea, and trying to coordinate a grassroots effort to publicize them. Whether that's writing articles, going to your local, in of court bar associations, maybe getting on local rules committees, as district courts start their own pilot projects or committees to address all the problems we've been talking about today, get on the panel, make sure your colleagues are aware of the Seventh Circuit principles. I don't know that we're actively seeking national uniformity at this point, but I think the idea is educational, is to make sure that people know that some of the homework has already been done, and if you like it, feel free to copy it, and if you can improve it, please do, and let us know about it. So we meet every once in a while, 2, 3, 4 months, so we have a phone call, we share ideas, we find synergies. Last time we talked, it turned out that a half dozen of our members were all meeting at the Sedona Conference in St. Louis, and so we arranged our own breakfast to get the folks together and meet in person. We are still a little light on volunteers in the 1st, 8th, and 11th circuits. So if anyone listening to this wants to get involved. Really anyone anywhere can get involved, but we especially could use volunteers in those circuits. Please shoot me an email. One place you can find me again is that website, discoverypilot.com, and we welcome everyone to come on board.
And I'd like to mention, we talked a little before the show that I've been involved with these localized networking groups, which I think are very, very effective to get local practitioners that focus on e-discovery talking to each other on a frequent basis and gelling sort of how to intelligently approach these issues. That these two approaches seem to be really very similar, and there's a group starting in Cleveland at the end of July. Indianapolis is launching a Friends of eDiscovery with 30 some odd people signed up for their first meeting, and which I'm going to next week or in 2 weeks. And I talked to some people in Nashville, and that goes along with Pittsburgh, Columbus, and Cincinnati. I think that there are lots of outlets for tapping into the national community that the internet helps us, tie into.
Yeah, and Carl, if I could add one more thought that I forgot, one of the most basic things people can do, and anyone listening to your podcast can do it, is if you read the principles and you like them, next time you're drafting a scheduling order, docket control order, whatever it's called in your locale, think about proposing them for your case on your own, right? There's nothing to prevent people from saying, most 26F reports I'm familiar with, at the very least, have a section at the end that says other matters, and in the judge's or the court's form order. Stick it right in there. Say, judge, the parties agree to abide by these principles to help them manage their electronic discovery, and we've attached them as Exhibit A. I've done that in a handful of cases and never had a judge say no.
There's nothing in the principles that is specific to the Seventh Circuit.
Yep. So, Mike, after doing the technology subcommittee program in May, I learned about the website that we've all said, except you haven't yet, but I think you will in a second, the discoverypilot.com, which has all sorts of useful information. Is there some sort of an internet strategy at play here that the Seventh Circuit's doing?
Well, I think it's interesting that the group met to come up with principles for the group, for the Seventh Circuit, but after the principles got developed and there was more interest in them, then I think the group got excited about kind of proselytizing for those. And so www.discoverypilot.com, there, I finally said it.
You're the last one. Congrats. Some judge is going to be very happy in the Seventh Circuit. So
it's a great resource, not just for those of us who are working on the pilot, but also for litigators, in-house folks, and anyone who's working in the area. If you go to www.discoverypilot.com, I get points every time I say that, don't I? If you go there, you can find presentations, you can find webinars that explore different aspects of the principles. There is a great section on cases and case law on e-discovery, which is very current and very useful. You can find webcasts, and you can go to the Phase 1 and Phase 2 report, and if you want to, you can read all 987 pages of the Phase 2 report, or focus on the first 50 pages of the summary. But it's a great resource, and it's thanks to, I think, really Judge Holderman for heading up the principles, and Judge Nolan for perpetuating the group, that we have these resources provided by great attorneys like the outside counsel who are on this call, but then the consultants who are involved in the group as well, like yourself, Carl, and other folks who give these resources and make them available to the courts and to the larger legal community.
So, Jeff, you were talking earlier about the second phase and looking into the third phase and the evolution. How does that evolution occur? What's the mechanics of it? Where do you decide as a group to tweak and adjust?
Sure. Well, we have the committee as a whole meets regularly. I think on average it's about 8 times per year. We meet over in a conference room at the district court with a very healthy participation of folks via phone. And then we have, as I mentioned, several subcommittees, all of which work on their own as appropriate in between the regular meetings. And then at the periodic meetings of the entire committee, we get updates from the subcommittees, generate additional ideas that fall under the auspices various committees. And we also, through the work that ART does, we try to monitor, pay attention to what other jurisdictions are doing through, national outreach and liaisons so that we can learn from them and hopefully they can from us. The committee continues to grow and expand its activities as additional needs are identified by members of the committee. We have formed just in the last year or so new subcommittees in the areas of criminal cases, the technology subcommittee, small cases, a subcommittee focused on small cases, and one of the subcommittees that we're actually particularly excited about heading into phase three is an e-mediation subcommittee, which is going to launch a program to free mediation of e-discovery disputes and cases that are pending in the district. The idea is that panel members will be trained in mediation techniques, and this is generally viewed as an extension or a logical extension of the committee's education program. So that's I guess in a nutshell how the committee stays up to date and continues to identify new ways of furthering the goals of the principals.
So Art, and really for any of you, have you seen firsthand how this program has impacted how co-participants litigate against each other?
Well, as I alluded to, I've generally been able to reach agreement both with opposing counsel and judges to use the principles in my cases. My patent cases are scattered around the country. We've really typically been able to agree. Now, I'll concede that sometimes I think that agreement isn't always fully informed. In other words, the other side might not have taken their liaison responsibilities to heart and just had no reason to agree or disagree. I put the principles in front of them, proposed them. They looked at them. They said, sure. But hey, that's fine. I think the principles, as we've said, are fair. I don't think they favor one side or the other. They're technology neutral. So if we get an agreement and we have a set of rules to live by, it allows me to give more concrete answers to my clients, and that is good for both them and for me. So cooperation has been enhanced, whether it's by accident or by design.
Yeah, I don't know if Jeff or Mike, if you want to add to that or go into the last question about where you see the biggest issues in the field of e-discovery, given your Seventh Circuit pilot program experience.
I don't have anything to add to the last answer. Mike, do you want to turn to where you see the program heading?
Yeah, and that's a good question. And I think as technology changes, the program will probably change to address the issues. The intent with the principles was to make them technology agnostic, but there may be issues that come up that need to be addressed more clearly. And this group, I think, is well-formed and has a good working relationship that they can address it. And the second area where I expect growth is, I think we've alluded to already, is ARTS efforts and Judge Holderman and Judge Nolan's efforts to expand the group, to proselytize for the process, to expand it geographically to a larger group. So those of you listening who are outside the Seventh Circuit, you've already heard a call to join. You may be hearing a call from people other than just the participants in this podcast. And finally, I think people are really excited about what you heard a few minutes ago about the e-mediation approach. So that would be taking the principles, the concepts behind them, and actually applying them as third parties to disputes that are in front of courts. And in many ways, I think that takes the expertise that the people on this panel have and makes that a resource to the larger legal community. So, and that, I think, is where things are likely to go in phase three.
Okay. Last question, we'll go Jeff, Mike, then Art. Is given your experiences in this pilot program and experiences in general, I always like to take a temperature read of what you see as the biggest issues in e-discovery at this point in time, July 5th, 2012.
This is Jeff, and I think what I see as the biggest issue is this is the need to continue, you know, this transition from a world where we used to ask for and expect to receive any and all documents related to a laundry list of topics, and into a world where now the objective really has to be how do you request and receive enough documents, you know, and by which I mean, you know, the documents that are sufficient to present your claims or defenses and that are proportional to the controversy, and how you can do that in this in this world of information explosion in a way that's both cost effective as well as acceptable and fair to both sides, and having attorneys become comfortable with concepts like cooperation and proportionality, I think are going to be critical to making that effective transition.
Okay, Mike, you have anything that you're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, just from an in-house perspective, one thing I think we can focus on is how do we design systems that recognize the need that any information on them may have to be put on legal hold, may have to be produced, may have to be searched in a way that's efficient. So from the get-go, designing the system so it can fit in there. And then obviously the thing that we're all kind of confronting now is predictive coding, how that technology is going to affect the way we do litigation and the way we respond to discovery requests.
Okay, and Art, it's never fun being last.
Well, it gave me time to think about my answer. I'll raise 2 points, one that's probably a negative and one that's a positive. On the negative side, I think that one of the challenges is the same challenge that we've had even in the pre-ESI world, and that is when one party, for strategic reasons, decides to be intentionally uncooperative. And notwithstanding our principles, which try to get those issues in the forefront early and get it in front of the judge, ultimately, I think we all need judges to enforce the rules. We have to recognize that the Sedona Conference and judges can give speeches all they want about how people should be nice and should cooperate, and sometimes a party is going to decide that is not in their best interest. And if not cooperating is against the rules, then I think we'd all be happier. And again, this isn't a pro-plaintiff or pro-defendant approach. It can be either side. But at some point, you know, we'd love to see the courts take a heavy, you know, at a certain point, take a heavy hand and give the rules some teeth. On the positive side, both of my colleagues here have mentioned predictive coding. I sometimes wonder if we're moving towards a world where we don't send requests for production under Rule 34 like we've all done for our whole careers. In the Eastern District of Texas, where I have a handful of patent cases, Judge Davis has a standing order that says that certain amount of days after the initial case conference, the case management conference, the parties are just supposed to turn over to each other everything that's relevant. And, well, that begs the question, what all is relevant, right? Well, do we move to a world where we just negotiate what the search terms are or, you know, and how we're going to use them? Is it Boolean logic? Is it predictive coding? But we generate a relevant, responsive, non-privileged pool in a manner other than a list of 100 requests for production. That may happen in, you know, I don't see the rules changing anytime soon, but as a matter of practice, that may be what we move to, and maybe that'd make all of our lives a little easier.
We're all moving to Europe. But anyway, this has been fascinating. I want to thank all of you, Jeff, Mike, and Art, for joining us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do more shows with you later this year. And I'd like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. I'm also going to mention www.discovery. I can't mute my writing. Pilot.com, discoverypilot.com. If there are points on the table, Mike, I got additional points.
Good.
Mentioning the website. To the listener, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember the show and website phonetically, as it sounds out as Easy Bytes of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, come back to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, President and Founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.